Welcome to Food Conversations Season 3. Food Conversations is a program about everything to do with food, starting with planting seeds, and then on to growing, harvesting, distributing, and eating, of course, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, The Voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. And actually, that's what we do. We are for the people, and with the people, and by the people at all times. Now, before we continue, I'd like to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepmik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming back Afka Zonderland, founder and of Okanagan Rossum Natural Foods, Inc., and I have the added pleasure of welcoming to the studio her daughter, Anna Gorman, who is the co-owner, and we'll call her the CEO, of Okanagan Rossum, and who for the last 7 years has been managing this well-known raw food producer. Welcome, Afka.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And welcome to our studio, Anna.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have both of you with us here. And today, last program, we talked about how this business began and how Afka's personal journey led her to that particular place. Today, we're going to talk about the nuts and bolts of Okanagan Rossum, how it works, a little bit about how it got started, and how it actually functions on a day-to-day basis or a week-to-week basis. So a little bit of origin story. Afka was approaching 60, and you said to yourself, I've had a successful career in interior design, and you told me about the fact that when you get into your 60s, that's your most productive years, so you're ready to rumble and do something new. And you'd always liked food, and cooking was always a big part of your life. So, Anna, I have you now here as a witness. You can say, what was it like eating your mom's food at home when you were growing up?
Well, it was really meat and potatoes when we were little. Like, so it was traditional Dutch. We had to eat liver. all that stuff.
Oh, dear.
Green beans. And then in my teenage years, mom kind of changed her way of eating because it wasn't serving her anymore. And right. Then we were along for the ride.
Right.
So we teased mom a lot about her hippy-dippy granola food and weird smoothies and why are you putting spinach in the smoothies? So we did tease mom a lot, and we're sorry for that, but we eventually but got on board.
Exactly. Look at the outcome. It was a good outcome. Afka, you were off at a Sunrider conference, and somebody gave you crisps.
Yeah.
And things started to happen in your brain, and you started to think about different ways to do things.
It just started with a cookbook, Real Food, Real Life. And that's where I found the recipe for what I had tasted in San Antonio, Texas. And I thought, this is amazing. This is huge nutrition. And it followed my hippie dippy.
Yes, you
thoughts.
Actually used the term hippie yourself. We were hippie farmers. Hippie
sure
farmers
were.
Grow their own food and they live self-sufficiently.
So there we went. I dried the first of the cran raisin crisps, and it still contained almonds at that time, in my oven. So there is a way to dry your own food in a really low setting of the oven.
Now, you had been off, by this time, you had been off to the Living Light Culinary Arts Institute in Fort Bragg. Fort Bragg, people think that's a fort in the middle of the prairie, but it's not. It's right on the coast, and it's a beautiful location. I went on Google Maps to see what fun you were having down there, and it was all bright and sunny and very, very nice looking. Did you ever meet, Anna, did you ever meet Sherry Soria and Dan Latterman? They were the people who were the progenitors of this operation.
I never met them. I just saw the cookbook and tasted all the recipes, and they were
you
really,
did the business
really
end of it.
Yeah, I was the taster. So.
What was that like when you talked about this transition? Your mom saw the light at the Living Light Culinary Arts Institute. What was it like for you? Suddenly you're seeing kind of a whole new food world around you.
Yeah, I think it was really inspiring, and there was such a need for something different, something healthy, food that makes you feel good instead of tired. And I think at the time our grocery stores were so limited, they didn't have anything to meet people's specific dietary needs, gluten-free. So here, you know, mom was coming home with these recipes and creating her own that kind of met all those needs and were delicious, because good food needs to be tasty. So there, I think we both recognized a need in our market.
Your mom talked about the eating first with your eyes and presentation. Did that play a role in the home versions of the food that went out, that is going out to the general public?
I think it did. I don't know if we always appreciated mom's cooking at the beginning, you know, because we were
It was
suspicious.
New and different. You were children. You're not supposed to do that to your children.
They were teenagers.
Oh, well, there we are.
Skeptic
That's a whole
teenagers.
New world.
Yeah, but definitely over time, you know, your taste buds adapt to good food, and then the other stuff doesn't taste so good anymore. You know, so
you're ruined.
You were ruined.
In a good way.
And then I can't go back.
Exactly what my husband said. You ruined me.
I can't go back to eat that other stuff.
No chips.
Now, one of the things that you did was you went down to Granville Island and you had an opportunity to cook an entire meal for a crowd of people. And that was a bit of a, not just a business development, but it's also a personal development to be able to cook all that food, these people, and have them all like it. That helped turn you around.
Those were amazing evenings. And to have an audience like 2023, and you had to talk while you prepared, it was very much a show and tell and taste. And I think that is the best way to really show people, and where the taste buds are involved, where the sight is involved. And of course, every course was served with the perfect wine. That's why they paid the $84 for a meal of nuts and seeds.
Well, nuts and seeds and wine, I'm sure there's something in some ancient publication saying that's what we eat around here. The legend has it that somewhere around 2005, you, Anna, said, Mom, you should sell this stuff.
Yes.
Did that really happen?
100%. No, I remember sitting in the kitchen and munching away and just kept eating and eating and eating. And yeah, there's... And we're honest with each other. I would never tell my mom to sell something that I didn't think was viable. And again, there was nothing in the market like it. So why not?
So there in your kitchen was born the idea for a business. Now, a business doesn't start out of nothing. So... How did the transition from your daughter saying you should sell this to you actually doing that? What were some of the steps that took place there?
Well, the first adventure happened at Wildflight Market. I brought my then two flavors, chocolate ginger crisps and cran raisin crisps, and sold out. But it was very time consuming to make. I didn't have the right tools. Huge. And I thought, my husband said, you're never going to make any money at this.
Those crisps you made in the oven, those
yes.
were oven crisps.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's. But pretty soon I had two Excalibers. And that's what I learned at the Culinary Arts Institute. That's what they used. Mm. But as we discussed last week, the humidity, like a one third of the weight in produce when you start drying is water. So that's running down the walls pretty quick.
And you ended up even with more Excaliburs.
Oh, we ended up with 9 in the end. And I didn't say this, but I had to get up, or I did go up with pleasure, out of bed in the night and shift trays around so that they would dry evenly. And I'm like, what am I doing?
Did you watch your mother getting up in the middle of the night or just roll over and look in the...
I had moved out by then, so okay. This was just... I couldn't witness that.
This is a story.
Yeah, it's a story.
So you had your Excaliburs. They were moistening your home, and the mold was flourishing or about to flourish. So then you had to move out of the home.
Yep.
So what happened at that point?
Well, actually, moving out of the home only happened 3 years ago, 4 years ago.
You mean you were molding your house for...
Well, in the basement.
In the basement. We got a new totally equipped drying machine.
And a certified
And that
kitchen.
Was in the basement first,
yeah.
before it went out to its own special home.
Oh, yes. And okay. by that time, the basement really was a certified kitchen. Stainless steel everywhere, you know, interior health, thus come and inspect us. Water samples are taken. Everything was up to snuff. But the new dehydrator made the difference.
So let's talk about that dehydrator, because it's a thing to behold. Let's talk about dimensions. Anna, how big is this monster?
Yeah, about 5 feet by 5 feet. So it's like a massive, yeah. So it's really wide, and it has about 14 large trays in it that we can fill up, and it'll make one batch a day because of the drying time.
Wow, so it really moves along.
Yeah, it circulates the air really well, so it's nice, even drying.
And the air goes out?
It does. So we had to cut a hole and vent it properly, and the basement...
And say goodbye to all the mold. Sorry.
Yeah. And once was a ping pong table, now there was a dehydrator. So that basement, yeah, has served us well.
Not the
years.
Typical transition in a basement, but a useful one, obviously.
Yeah.
So... You didn't just buy a big dehydrator, Afka. You got a little help.
Absolutely. We got I believe it was a FoodSafe grant, and we qualified. And the organization that put that in place is the Small Scale Food Processing Association. And they have a membership all over BC of about 600 small businesses. So small business or family-operated business contribute hugely to the well-being of not just local people, but provincially. And I believe, Anna, you might correct me on that, it was the agriculture minister who was a guest speaker when we won a nice award as being in the top five of BC food producers. And mentioned that a lot of our tax base and employment happened in the small businesses.
Indeed. It's well recognized that small businesses are the major employer in the province. You hear about the big operations in the news, but the actual small businesses are where people are working, actual people are working. So did you have a business plan? Did you just make it up as you went along? Or
yeah. Pretty much.
Anna, you're shaking your head.
No, it was just, let's see where this takes us. There
yes,
wasn't
okay.
any official business write-up, and mom's instincts are
this
really good.
This is the hippie way.
That is. And you see success, and you just keep going. And then you get some good stores. I think Nature's Fair, Askew's were some of the first stores we were in. And then they just kept supporting us, and we kept getting more stores, and it just kind of kept going.
What was that like, starting like Topsy and making it grow?
You knock on a lot of doors. You build relationships yeah. with the people that say yay or nay in the stores.
Yeah, sure, the store managers, that kind of thing. So, Anna, while this Genesis process was taking place, you had moved away, or you'd already moved away. What were you doing? I mean, lots of kids on farms move away to see the rest of the world.
I was traveling, and then I started, went to school for interior design, and I was living in Vancouver. So for about a decade, I did hospitality and corporate interior design. So was not on a farm. And it was living the city life. And but funny enough, I was always considered the office granola, even in downtown Vancouver. So I was just expanding my skill set and learning lots of new things, and starting a career.
Now, you did interior design. Your mom had done interior design.
Yes.
Was there a connection between the two?
I think so. I think it was a way to be really creative and still get a paycheck. You know, if I could be an artist, I'd be an artist, but that doesn't pay the bills. So this was just a nice, happy, happy place for me to be.
If you'd been back in Holland, maybe an artist would have been able to pay the bills.
Yes. Anna is a good artist.
Well, in this part of the world, we don't respect creativity the way it's done in many other parts of the world. So you, at some point, said, maybe I'm going to go back to the farm. Maybe I'm going to get another kind of paycheck. How did that work? What was that transition? Because you'd done a decade in the big city.
Well, I met my husband, mm-hmm. and then we moved to Edmonton. and started a family. And I just didn't want to be behind a computer 8 hours a day. I didn't want to travel anymore. And I just wanted to have a change and be home with my kids and have some flexibility so I could be a present parent. And that was important to me after just dedicating my last 10 years of my life to work. So I know mom was experiencing a lot of success with the business, but also needed some help. Mm-hmm. So it was this perfect timing where I could come home and help her grow the business and also spend time with my babies.
So. How did that change things for you, Afka, having two more generations of the family come back to be part of what's going on?
It was fabulous. I mean, every grandparent will tell you to have little ones around is a gift. And I remember when Anna's little boy was born, I think she was back on day two. It was getting boring at home, Mom. We had feeding the baby breaks and sometimes a little nap, but she was there. And that was amazing. And Anna came in at a perfect timing where I thought, where's this going? How long can we sustain this? And it became, I had one steady employee, and we worked side by side, and then the shows and the markets and the trip to Calgary and Vancouver. I did a lot of driving. I put in a lot of time. And I thought, okay, well, this is fine. Now what? But it's also, it was your baby, right? You started something and you grew something. So you have a lot of emotional involvement. And at some point, you need to let the baby do its own thing. It's like growing up. And that's when Anna said, I could do this. It started really off when Anna, we had some Edmonton stores. And she said, why don't I do a demo? And yeah. I don't believe it was my first reaction.
What did you not believe?
That she would just go out and meet the public and peddle mom's business. I mean, really, she had a really good job, made lots of money, and then to be doing that. But she's actually very good at it and very like approachable, like people, oh, what have we got here? So I think in that time span, she decided, I could do this. And I thought, she can do this.
So I had to prove myself.
You crossed the barrier.
That's right.
You're in the inner circle.
Yep.
So what did you first do when you came back? I mean, you came back specifically to start working in the business. So how did that start? You're an interior designer by trade.
Yeah.
Like your mother, seems to be all interior designers, do they end up producing food? I don't know. We'll do a study.
Yeah, small percentage.
For sure. Very small percentage. Yeah. So what's that like?
I think I was able to look at the business with some fresh eyes. And I think my goal coming in was to make it a long-term sustainable business and look at the marketing, look at the packaging, look at the food safe aspect. So as we grew, we would be well positioned and we would have all our ducks in a row because, you know, mom had just been growing this thing and not necessarily thinking it would go as far as it would. Mm-hmm. And then here we were. So I think it was just taking some of my corporate, experience and applying some of that to the business to make it sustainable. So I know mom was really gracious at letting me do my own thing and making changes to her baby that she probably wouldn't have if I didn't keep saying, no, mom, we got to do this. You know, this is what people are needing to do, you know, what the stores are asking for, what consumers would like to see. So I definitely pushed her a lot at the beginning to make some changes, and she graciously let me have my way.
So. What were the major changes, you know, in very practical terms, what were the major changes? You said about food safe, you said about packaging and promoting. I think you told me, Afka, that the packaging was designed by Anna, that was your layout and an idea that you had. What other stuff?
I think also just the social media component was a huge part.
There is a generational gap in social media.
Yeah, my mom didn't want to have anything to do with that, but it's a need, and fair. Yeah, it's a
source of expanding a business very readily.
For sure.
Yeah.
And then we did a big food safety program as well. So. And that was also through the SSFPA Association. So it was more of a, really intense, let's look at all aspects of the business to see if we're vulnerable in any different parts from a food safety aspect. Because if you don't have a safe product, you should not be in the food business. So I think for us, it was really important to make sure that the foundation was solid.
And the Canada Food Inspection Agency is not necessarily entirely user-friendly if they don't like something. If you could see the expression on both Anna and Afka's face right now, there's a certain wave of nausea sweeping.
Yeah, but it's necessary,
Well,
I appreciate where they're coming from.
But it can sometimes be a bit draconian. We talked in the last program, Afka and I talked a little bit about what happened to Gort's Gouda. And how one red pepper mishap, which was not actually their mishap, it was simply a supplier's mishap, led to a massive destruction of their food product, and was a huge setback. So it's something you do not want to have happen. Yeah. You've had some inspections, Afka, and they've worked out fine.
After a while, you build up a trust with, it was then Interior Health in Kelowna that came, and there'd be regular visits. And so they get to know how you're doing things, and also that it was important for us to be in safe. It's like, to be safe, we have to follow the rules, if not for any other reason, then we don't want anybody to have an upset stomach or a celiac reaction. That hurts a lot. And so we learned as we went along. Cross-contamination changed. We had separate sheets for separate flavors. All of those things. Proper storage.
Allergens.
Allergens. Like, it has to be handled with care, because we always had the consumer in mind. What if it makes somebody sick? How would you feel?
Indeed. Indeed, it would probably make them feel not very happy. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit then, now that this baby is growing and is still growing, why don't we talk a little bit about what a typical, I'm going to suggest a weekly basis, because you stock the dehydrator once a week. So it seems to me that's a unit we could probably start with. So how does the week go? Anna, the dehydrator is stocked, it's run its course, the food in it is now dry. Mm-hmm. What happens next?
We hand package. So we do have some help throughout the week, which is great. But for the most part, it's three of us that either are making the product or taking it out of the dehydrator, and then we hand package each box.
So you take the actual dehydrated food, it's already
dry.
Organized?
It's already dried, so we take it off, we have to weigh it, we put it in bags, and then we seal it and put it in our colorful boxes that you see on the shelf.
But these crisps have corners on them, they're square, they're longitudinal objects. How do you go from a bunch of amorphous food in a dehydrator to a certain shape?
Well, we have a mold. So it is, 3x4 that we hand spread over this mold. So that was a real game changer. So now we have these uniform, crackers that we can just take 4 or 5. We know roughly what it's going to weigh. And then we can package that way. So
you do the weighing after you've made them into crackers or before?
After.
And then you put them into little plastic bags? And
yeah, clear
seal.
Poly bags, mm-hmm. And then we have a heat sealer, so then we can seal the product and then put them in the boxes.
Now, I know one elaborate step that some larger businesses take, they will put something like nitrogen in the bag so that there's no oxidation. Mm-hmm. But you have room air, so that there is sort of a rough best before date on your pack on, yes. on your package?
Yeah, we're about 6 months shelf life.
Yeah.
Depending on the flavor. They'll last for years, but what happens is they sometimes soften. So we can't really sell a soft crisp.
So that thing that you thought would break went, no, it drooped instead.
But, you know, a lot of our customers buy in bulk from us and they can freeze our food. So if they want to take advantage of some savings and just buy a whole bunch when we have a sale, they can throw it in their freezer and they can just pull it out. It'll be nice and crisp. So nice there's ways around the best before date.
You have a walk-in freezer.
Thing of beauty.
That's right. I mean, this is for a small scale business, this is industrial strength machinery. So walk-in freezer, what's that all about?
It allows us to process fresh fruit when it's in season, either from the local farms like West Enderby Farms, through thousands of kilos of beautiful big juicing carrots for us. They now morphed on to some different varieties, so now we get our carrots and beets from them in the fall when they're just amazing in taste and very crisp. We process those. And I lost my train of thought. What's it like?
Well, for the freezer.
So we process them, and this is a matter of peeling, juicing them, combining the juice and the pulp, which is the perfect consistency for a crisp, freeze them as they come in. So it is like one day we get a bag full of beautiful fresh carrots, the next day it's in the freezer. It's not en route, it's not sitting in a warehouse, it is there, and all of those wonderful nutrients are sealed in.
So we can process all the fruits and vegetables that we need for our crackers and have them all year round in this big, massive freezer. So that's a huge advantage.
When we get towards the end of the show, I'm going to bring up an article by George Monbiot on the collapse of the global food system. And what you've just described now is a much older way of dealing with food. You store it, you keep it on hand. And this applies to both commercial food operations and homes. It's the same issue, but on a different scale. We will be pointing out at some point down the road today that what you're doing is really in the forefront of a transformation back to a secure food system. Just had to throw that in because we are all about food sovereignty and food security. So you've got the food prepared, you've got it in bags, you've got it in boxes. Then it has to go somewhere. So what happens then?
Once it's all packaged in our nice colorful boxes, you mean?
Yes, I do mean that.
Yes, we ship everything direct to our retailers. So we're one of the few businesses that self-distribute. And that is a huge advantage to us because any of your traditional distributors, they charge 30% to the small business to have the privilege to send your product to different retailers. And that was just a deal breaker for us. That's not a viable business plan. So we are fortunate our product is light. And we pack it, put it in our shipping boxes for whatever store and ship it either UPS, FedEx, Canada Post, or
You ship it through the mails.
Ship it through the mail. Yeah.
I had a vision of somebody driving down the road all over the province.
No, well, my husband does sometimes. So it's a really great way to get product to the store. Unfortunately, as the bigger chains don't always allow the little guys to self-distribute. So they don't accept your product unless you go through a distributor, which is really unfortunate, but most of our retailers will accept, FedEx, UPS.
So how did you get, AFCO, especially at the beginning, how did you get these retailers on side?
Personal calls.
Hustle. A lot of hustle.
A lot of hustle.
Yeah. And it was fun. I enjoyed being on the road, the opportunities, and on vacation, I always brought a sample pack. We went through Caslo. Hey, Horn of Plenty, that looks like a store that was... So I stopped by, talked to the owner. Before we got back, Anna had her first order.
Now, I laboriously copied out the list of all your current retail outlets, and it's extensive. And I'm just going to rattle some names off, and maybe I'll pick one out, and you can tell me how you met them if you remember. Okay, so BC, there's retailers in Armstrong, Burnaby, Campbell River, Castlegar, Courtney, Cranbrook, Duncan, Fort St. John, Fernie, Golden, Grindrod in Vermeer, Kamloops, Kelowna, Langley, Ladysmith, Nanaimo, Salt Spring Island, Saanich, Sydney, Slocan, Vancouver, the Lower Mainland, Vernon, and Victoria. Now, that's enough to make a person dizzy. That's a lot of retail outlets. So let's talk about one that's probably everybody has heard about somewhere, Nature's Fair.
They were, they were the very first store that had more than one outlet that say, yeah, we will do that. And I did do a luncheon for all the staff members, so it became personal. They also hired me to do a one-minute clip on the Vernon radio station for a year.
And for so a year?
One for
minute
a year.
For a year.
They had a contract with the Vernon radio station, and later on I heard how much that cost. Really? And I thought, whoa. But it was, again, you become familiar with, or they become familiar with your story, and you're just meeting people, and it was different, and people are always intrigued by difference. And I was always full of enthusiasm. It was cool stuff.
So Alberta has also been susceptible to your blandishments. Edmonton, Calgary, Lethbridge, Red Deer, and St. Albert. Do you remember St. Albert? Amaranth?
Amaranth Foods.
Yeah.
What happened there? I mean, it's not exactly on the main highway.
I was in Edmonton.
I was living at Edmonton at
and
the time.
And Anna was there. Yeah. And I realized that Amaranth Food, a small one, who had actually sponsored one of my dinners at Crowfoot liquor store, that they had three stores. They said, we also have a new one in St. Albert. And I was there for the dinner with my food angel. They said, let's check it out. It was a very posh little store. And there we were.
And you just walked in and said, would you like some of these to sell?
Yes, pretty much.
And they said, sure, why not? And do you keep track of individual stores and how much they're selling? I mean, you know some that must be, you know, the market there is much more vigorous. Do you kind of keep track of that, or is it just kind of ad hoc, Anna?
No, I keep track of it because part of my, you know, weekly duties is seeing if stores need an order. So usually you have to call them and say, hey, what do you need? So I have to keep track of what's what, and then I can, you know, go down my list.
So where do you find the most, is it location specific? Is it store specific? Is it region specific?
I think it's probably store specific. I think like the Nature's Fair of the world, they attract a certain clientele where they prioritize their food choices, and they want quality food and local food, and they know to go there if that's what they want. So we definitely find it's more of the retailer and what they're promoting and if our product is a good fit or not.
Have you had any disappointments, stores that you went to that seemed to be just right up your alley and then didn't work out that way?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it kind of ties into the politics of the grocery store system. Probably one of the biggest disappointments was, we originally got Capers, which is a Vancouver chain, locally owned, wonderful, one of our top stores. And then it got bought by Whole Foods, and it was still pretty good. Then Whole Foods got bought by Amazon, and our sales dropped by 80%. So, you know, we see this disturbing pattern, and, you know, they're one of the chains that do not accept vendors unless they are with a large distributor, because it's just not efficient for them otherwise. So they put us on the bottom shelf in the back corner of the store, and now we were underperforming, you know, and they started dropping products. So it's stuff like that that's really disheartening, because it was a lot of hustle, it was a lot of effort, it was a lot of demos to get, you know, the sales up as where they were. And then in just one transaction, poof.
It's interesting because what you came up against was really a structure. It wasn't a market failure. It was a structural obstacle that could not be overcome.
Yeah, totally out of our control. And that's disappointing.
And it's interesting that a large-scale operation would do that. In the article that we'll be getting into a little bit by George Monbiot, he points out that when businesses become very systematized and sort of efficiency oriented, efficiency meaning moving product in large volumes at
a numbers
high speed,
game. Yeah.
It makes them very vulnerable. They're not vulnerable the way you're vulnerable. You're going to say, would you retail our product? They're vulnerable because if a supply problem emerges, if there's an extreme weather event that's interrupting the supply chain, or, as has now happened, the fuel cost for all these massive delivery operations suddenly doubles, they have no recourse. Okay. You're much more nimble and agile. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's why big business is not always the answer to the best thing. Now, it's one thing to have food, but to get the food, you have to have some way to grow it. You have some gardens. Afka.
I've been happily planting and seeding and raking for the last, well, since it got warmer. It was too cold for those poor little seeds for so long. And it's my happy space. I never resent it, rarely, even the weeding. It's being out there. And
well, you were trained in Holland after the war when milking the cows took place out in the field, no matter what the weather was, even if it was pouring rain. This was a much nicer operation.
You can't take the farm out of a girl, or at least this girl.
So you play a major role in the garden.
Yeah, I do.
Anna, do you play a role in the garden too?
Not as much. No, I process it once it's in the kitchen, but sure. Mom's in charge of all the gardening and the planting. Yeah. And so, yeah, Mom grows most of the greens for our one flavor, our garden cracker. And some of the beets and some of the carrots, and then we get the rest from other local farms.
How far away do you go to get food? How far away is, say, I mean, I know there's some products that come, you know, coconut comes from far away, certified mm-hmm. organic, etc.
Yeah.
But in terms of the basic veggie source?
The furthest is Carameas for the apples.
Yeah, and then the rest is Mara Valley produce, which is 5 kilometers from our house.
So. A massive 5 kilometers.
Yeah.
Not likely to be destroyed by an extreme weather event. So you grow some of the stuff, you purchase some of the stuff through local farms. Let's talk a little bit about what kind of stuff you purchase, because I went on your website and I got the list of the qualities of the food that you sell. And they're fairly distinct and clear, and I think constructive. So, vegan, you have a lot of vegan stuff, almost everything. Well,
100% vegan.
100% vegan, yeah. Okay. Low glycemic. Do you want to explain that a little bit, Afka, for...
Oh, okay.
Or Anna?
Oh,
it was a hand signal you couldn't see, listeners.
A few years back, we had a registered dietitian review all our crackers. And the beauty of our food is that because we use a lot of sprouted seeds, it's that protein is balanced with the sugars in the apples and the dates. So we don't use any refined sugars. And because it's so well balanced, it's considered low glycemic and even approved for diabetics. It's just this beautiful, slow burning fuel. And it gives you the kind of energy that we want. So, we find a lot of people are trying to find, high quality food that's low glycemic, in general, the hikers, the bikers, people that are active that want quality mm-hmm. calories.
And that's a trend that research has shown is increasing steadily. And local growers are starting to notice it. Keto-friendly. That's playing into a mm-hmm. current interest in consumers, Afka?
The protein balancing, and it's also the fat content. And I eat a high-fat diet from good fats like avocados and
for sure.
coconuts. So a lot of that, our ingredients are high fat and actually omega-3s. It's hugely important to balance your omega-3s and omega-9s. So that's where flaxseed comes in. And as an aside, when I first started, we got all our flax from the Western producers in Canada. Now, sometimes it comes from Peru, because Canada could not make, or the company, our wholesaler, couldn't get the right price from the Western producers. So that was really sad. Hmm. And there was nothing we could do. And we try again. We're trying to find again the kind of ingredients that should be available to us, because it's grown in Canada. But to get back to the keto diet, a really good source of fat comes from the flax. And so we grind the flax for complete absorption just before we make the batch, because fat and omega-3s are really vulnerable.
Absolutely.
To heat and light.
Polyunsaturated fat is
absolutely
highly vulnerable.
So,
yes.
And if we make some of the flax situations ahead of time, it goes in the freezer until we're ready to use that flax for that batch. So we're very careful that we handle all the ingredients as they deserve to be handled for maximum nutritional benefit.
Now, you're also gluten-free and grain-free, because mm-hmm. there's other grains that don't have gluten. That was a deliberate step?
Yes, very much so. Grain has been a problem for quite a few years for many, many people. Foggy brain, to say of anything. And it isn't that grain is necessarily contaminated, but it is the sprouting element of grain that makes it much, much easier to digest. And of course, we now know that desiccants are sprayed on the crop just before harvesting, which yep. is just one different way of calling glyphosate a desiccant.
Yeah, just to clarify for listeners, desiccation is a process where you kill the plant, but you kill it slowly. And as you do so, the plant sends energy into its seeds. And so farmers are drawn to using glyphosate primarily as a desiccant, i.e. a poison, because it increases their output by about 15% of seeds. So it's a pure market-driven process, which also results in quite substantial residues of glyphosate in grain. I've mentioned this on the show before, that for many products, you'll see a little icon that says GMO-free. But unfortunately, most grains are actually sprayed and with this desiccant glyphosate about 2 weeks, 15 days, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before harvesting. So actually, non-GMO, unfortunately, unless it's organic as well, doesn't mean as much as it used to. It's actually no longer relevant. Mm. Sprouted and raw. Well, I think it's Okanagan Rawsome gives us a pretty good idea what the raw part is. Sprouted, do you do some sprouting?
All of the seeds are soaked for anywhere from 3 to 6 hours, and which takes care of that leptin coating that seeds come with. And leptin coating on seeds is there for the very fact that it protects the seed from being attacked by fungi, mm-hmm. Those kind of things. So you're actually energize and activate all the incredible micronutrients in that seed. Again, like all the little things that, it's not just about protein, it's not just about fat, it's all about the minerals especially
and micronutrients
that complete our meal. So the variety and the availability of the nutrients, like I think you get more money for your buck when all of the things that you eat actually get absorbed by your body.
So producing food that is rich in micronutrients and quality and not saturated with agrochemicals that are not desirable in our bodies. Have you thought about expanding, doing more?
Yes, it's like the yo-yo. We should do something more, like the creativity instinct, you know, checks in with me. And then we start doing the numbers, and then we start looking at the extra work, and we think, no, I think we're fine. And to me, more is not always right. Enough is perfect many times over. because especially as a family, you want a balanced life and that we can handle and not be stressed out. But I have no desire to be stressed out about more things. And the industry is changing so quickly. It's really hard to plan ahead.
That's a good segue into the changes that are taking place in the industry, because there are significant changes taking place. And I said earlier today that you're in the vanguard of some of the changes that are starting to mount up progressively. In the Guardian newspaper about a week ago, George Monbiot, who's a well-known journalist who writes a lot about progressive issues and about the state of the world, he's got a new book out called, I think, Regeneration, which I think is a regenesis, which is the Latin version of regeneration. And the title of this article he wrote is The Banks Collapsed in 2008 and Our Food System is About to Do the Same. Mm-hmm. A couple of days ago, I passed on some pictures of empty food shelves in Salmon Arm that took place after the debris flows and floods destroyed much of the highway infrastructure leading north-south in British Columbia. That's a small part of the collapse. What's happened now is that we have a completely unnecessary and tragic war taking place in Central Europe, and we have growing impacts from climate change everywhere starting to impact the food system as well as the rest of society. What changes are you, the two of you, Anna, maybe you could mm-hmm. comment on this. You're looking at the future, a longer future than your mom. Mm-hmm. So what kind of changes do you see happening and how are they affecting you personally?
Yeah, we've noticed a lot of changes in the last couple years. Supply chain issues, for sure. For the first time, we've had our suppliers say, sorry, there's no sesame seeds. Go look elsewhere. Or there was, tsunami in the Philippines. We don't have coconut for the next half year. So for the first time, I'm having to look at different suppliers just to get these ingredients that we never had problems getting before. So that really makes us think, do we need to completely change our recipes?
Have you decided to make a change in the ingredients you use because of the instability of the supply?
Well, a while ago, we took out almonds just because of the environmental impact and the cost. And I think more and more we're looking at our flavors and see, okay, can we make this without coconut? Can we use something more local instead? For the first time ever, it is more affordable for us to source our flax and our buckwheat from Fieldstone Organics outside of Armstrong, which was just, I did a huge yahoo, because before we were getting stuff from India and all over, and it was way cheaper. And so now, you know, their prices haven't gone up as much as the global market, and that feels really good to be able to just drive down the road and pick up some of these ingredients. So we're definitely looking at what they can offer and how we can adapt our recipes just locally. So
George Monbiot points out in his article that food production has actually increased in the last several decades faster than the population growth. But because of maldistribution, and that has been identified by many experts, it's going to the wrong people, in too much to some people and not enough to others, and the quality of the food is not necessarily as high as it should be.
No.
So you're addressing that, Afka. This quality thing, as you were saying earlier, has been an important issue from the very start.
Food for a family, people are struggling to meet their food bill sometime, or certain parts of our society. Food is important, but it's really expensive, and organic food and high quality food, well, it needs to be more expensive. But I still see people making that choice, because when you eat quality food, your sense of satisfaction, it is satisfying, and you're not hungry an hour later. When your body has had all the nutrients, like for brain to muscle, I'm good. And you learn to say, I'm good. Maybe a little bite of chocolate after dinner. But we eat very few non-foods.
Now, you also mentioned, you said organic food costs more.
Yes.
For you, with short supply lines, family farm production methods, a big hydrator in a building next to your home, and a garden right next to that, and your food producers all around you, have you been a little less, for example, George Monbiot pointed out that food cost inflation was 9% per month in the United Kingdom very recently. Have you been struck with that same, you know, pressure to start increasing your prices because of some cost variables that you can't control?
Yeah, sadly, we never want to put up our prices. I think our goal is to create really good quality, affordable food. But yeah, the shipping costs have gone up enormously. Basically, everything has gone up. So we did have to put our prices up recently, but we really try to balance that with doing a lot of some good specials on our online store. So then people can just buy in bulk.
Sure.
and take advantage of some of those savings. So we've had to find some efficiencies here and there. And luckily, how we're set up, we're extremely efficient. And then my dad is free labor, so that helps.
One for John.
That's right.
Have you felt less vulnerable to some of the shipping costs that are really shattering some of these long supply lines?
100%, for sure. Like, we still feel it, but not to the same extent. And I think we're grateful that we've decided just to stay within BC and Alberta. And that's, you know, all we need. We don't need to expand to the States. We don't need to expand out east. We've got plenty of customers just in these two provinces, and that will sustain us.
That's right. So you're, in a way, you're insulated for the longer term, not just for the short term, but for the longer term against some of these shocks, which, again, George Monbiot points out, are inevitable when he describes the food system as nodes, which he described as knots on a netting, and then supply lines, which are the rope on a netting that goes from one knot to another. When they're all the same and they're all tightly interconnected, shattering one part of that affects the whole system. But he points out that producing food that's different, foods that's local, and food that's easily accessible, you know, don't have to go a long distance to get it, is the key to sort of the changeover that we need to have in order to stabilize and give security and food to the population. Mm-hmm. How do you feel, Afka? You started this operation, this food operation. Did you see at the beginning that in addition to creating nutritious food, you'd also be developing a project that is kind of future-oriented as well? It's looking into where things are going to go in the future.
Well, that's where my lack of a business plan came in. You just, all along, you tiptoe around the problems and make possibilities out of it where eventually you know you're going to thrive. And I've always had a sentiment, we can thrive if we put our boots on the ground, we do the work, we will always be flexible, and we can turn on a dime.
Mm-hmm. And so can you think of some dimes you've turned on recently, ways that you've made changes, Anna, in... You mentioned one, that you were sourcing flax in a different way. Mm-hmm. But if you change some of your other... I mean, initially you were driving product around, weren't you, Afka? Or was it always mailed out?
It was mailed out at the very beginning. And then when driving became too far, I wasn't... When we were going places, like Anna's husband has to go to Edmonton, he's going to drop that order off in Revelstoke. Like, that's how she rolls. When John's going somewhere, or Anna, anybody, hey, we've got an order. So that's $20, and it adds up. We've always been counting the pennies in between and shifting and being frugal in a way, if we get back to that sentiment.
And speaking of frugality, it's essentially not spending money that you don't have. Has that been a theme in the operation? You've learned from your mother's model. Has that been something that's sort of been part of the core structure of the business?
For sure. The business has never grown too fast or too quickly. You know, we grew a little bit, saved some money, got another piece of equipment. So it was just this really organic process. And we didn't, you know, Mom didn't put a second mortgage on the house and just try to make something work. It was just always, let's try this. If it works, then we'll, you know, invest a little bit more in here and there. And I thought that was really smart, and keeping overhead as low as possible.
Well, you're right in tune with this article in The Guardian by George Monbiot, who's very well known as a student of world affairs. What he closes in, he says, we urgently need to diversify global food production, both geographically and in terms of crops and farming techniques. We need to break the grip of massive corporations and financial speculators, and we need to create backup systems producing food by entirely different means. Mm-hmm. I would have to say, Anna and Afka, that you identified the problem before it was identified by the experts, and you're producing an example of what the future needs to bring. So yes. I want to thank both of you for coming in. Anna, it's nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Afka, it's nice to have you back. You've really, I think, given our listeners a lot to think about.
Thank you. It's exciting to go forward.
Thank you very much.